There are some commonly held ideas about where different groups of people fall on the political spectrum and their political attitudes. Working class whites, Republican, maybe solidly behind President Trump. People of color, solidly Democratic. The rich Republican, maybe educated whites, rural, urban. The story, especially when it comes to race and class and how they intersect, is actually much more complex. And our next guest says that just about everyone, from average Americans to high-level political strategists, are getting it wrong. Ian Haney-Lopez holds an endowed chair as the Chief Justice Earl Warren Professor of Public Law at the University of California, Berkeley. He co-founded the Race Class Narrative Project and is the author of several books, including Dog Whistle Politics, How Coded Racial Appeals Have Reinvented Racism and Wrecked the Middle Class. His latest book is Merge Left, Fusing Race and Class, Winning Elections and Saving America. Ian, welcome to Central Time.
Delighted to be able to join you.
Well, you've researched and written a lot about race and politics. You've talked to a lot of everyday Americans about these topics, too. And as you write, you found that a lot of the sort of shorthands we use about people, groups of people in particular, really hide a lot of complexity at the individual and group level. What kind of things do you find when you go out and listen to people?
You find that there's a set of stereotypes that are fundamentally racist stereotypes, stereotypes about people of color as inherently dangerous and as undeserving and lazy, that are quite pervasive because they're very often expressed in dog whistle terms. And the idea there is these are terms that on the surface are silent about race. Think about a term like illegal alien, or a term like the American heartland, or thugs and gangbangers, or the silent majority. You can't exactly pinpoint where race is mentioned because it's not mentioned. But these terms trigger these underlying racist stories about who's deserving, who's undeserving, who's hardworking, who's lazy, who's law-abiding, who's criminal. And what we found is once you start to use those coded terms, that they're so pervasive that they are convincing not just to a majority of Republican voters, and this is sort of a Republican political dynamic that gets started 50 years ago, so that's not much of a surprise, but they're also convincing to a majority of Democratic voters, to a majority of union households. And then you may think to yourself, well, this is really a racial story, you know, of whites versus people of color, so at least people of color won't fall for this. That's not true either. These coded messages warning about lazy people, undeserving people, dangerous, violent people, these messages are convincing to a majority of African Americans and a majority of Latinos as well.
You talk about an interesting kind of a mini focus group with a couple of, I think it was white working class guys who express some of those dog whistle ideas you just talked about, and in the same conversation expressed what people would consider very anti-racist attitudes at the same time. We contain a diversity of perspectives even within ourselves as individuals.
So I got to say that this is huge and really good news, but I also want to say it's really surprising. So I'm a professor who studied racism for 25 years now, and I too had this assumption that, you know, there's a lot of racism out there, and that you know, when we start trying to figure out how we're going to deal with it and push back against it, we're gonna find racist ideas. And we did, right? We started this focus group. We did this national research project. We did focus groups with whites, African Americans, Latinos, Asian Americans, Somalis. And as we talked to different people, we encountered a lot of stereotypes. But the thing I did not appreciate, and this is really revelatory, the thing I didn't appreciate is that most people they're not just one thing. People are complex, and they are toggling between deeply racist stereotypes on the one hand and racially egalitarian views that really recognize the beauty of seeing our humanity in each other's smiles. And I didn't know that. And, you know, to make it more concrete, we start this project trying to figure out how to push back against racism in politics by talking with a couple of white guys in Ohio, and they said some racist stuff, right? The welfare queen stuff, and you can't go into certain neighborhoods, and it just happens to be black and brown, and you're not safe. And, you know, and I was thinking, we're dead. How are we going to do this? And the more they kept talking, they also started saying things like, you know, but my children, my daughter, she's got a black baby doll and she didn't realize the difference. And it's just beautiful. And I use that as the image for my Facebook page. And so here you have this person who, on the one hand, expresses some racist stereotypes, and on the other hand, clearly embraces an ideal in which we recognize each other's humanities unburdened by racism in a way that really is just that believes in the solidarity of human beings. People are going back and forth between both. And that's really good news because it means that in this era in which there's so much racist stereotyping going on, in which there's so much racial division, our task as people who want to build a healthy society is not to tear down a mountain of racism, but it's to convince people that the racially progressive views they already hold, that it's their racial hopes that can help move them and their families forward.
Talking to Ian Haney-Lopez, his new book is Merge Left, Fusing Race and Class, Winning Elections, and Saving America. And you, Ian, have a project in this book. You're trying to figure out how to reach out in the conversation about race and about class and develop it into, in effect, a progressive political movement. What do you think about the way the Democratic Party talks about race and class, sometimes as opposing issues?
Yeah, they really do think of them as opposing, or at least as very separate issues. And so it's quite common to hear Democrats say, hey, we need to do racial justice and we need to promote economic fairness. We're going to do both. But to really treat them as different and indeed as aimed at different audiences, there's a racial justice conversation that happens with communities of color. There's this economic populism that happens with the white audiences. It's just there's an enormous mistake here. And I want to signal this is a mistake I used to make. In fact, this is a mistake that was fundamental to how I thought about racism for many years as a scholar of racism. The fundamental mistake is to think about racism as more than anything else, a conflict between whites and people of color, that there's some sort of war between these racial groups. There is that conflict. We need to deal with it as a society. I'm not denying that conflict is there. But why is there so much conflict? What's behind it? And who benefits from it? This is the perspective that completely changed for me when I began to study the way in which racism is purposefully used in politics, because it turns out some of the most powerful, wealthiest forces in our society, segments of our society, intentionally promote racial division. And in this way, race and class aren't separate. If you think about the party of big business, or you can think about somebody like Donald Trump as this billionaire who wins power as a man of the people, how did Trump win power? Well, he ran on a campaign that stressed themes of racial division and racial fear. And then he's turned around and governed in a way that has passed a massive tax cut for the biggest corporations and the wealthiest families. The issues of racial division and wealth inequality and the way in which as the economy grows, all of the benefits are going to the top 0.1%. Those are not separate issues. They're the same issue, because racial division is precisely the way in which people are distracted from focusing on how government and the economy increasingly work for the very wealthiest.
How do you bring up the conversation about race? You write in your book that often when people point out racial inequities or racially charged, they say, political messages, you say they're met with accusations that bring up that issue is in itself racially divisive.
That's it. That's exactly right. So think about how this conversation goes. We started already by saying, hey, when these messages are expressed in code as illegal aliens and the American heartland, the majority of people agree with it. And the majority of people means the majority, including Democrats and African-Americans and Latinos. So now if progressives turn around and say, hey, you know, people, when they talk about illegals in the heartland, that's racist. Most people think, I don't that doesn't sound racist to me. That sounds like common sense. And if you're saying that's racist to a politician who says that, you're kind of saying I'm racist. And I'm not racist. I'm just worried, right? And so what happens is we get stuck in this sort of feedback loop where politicians who are exploiting dog whistles are intentionally triggering racist stereotypes, but they're doing it in a way that allows them to deny that that's what we're doing. So then when we call them out and say, no, that's racist, they say, I didn't say any racist thing at all. There's nothing. I didn't mention race at all. But you called me a racist, and that's racist against me. You're stereotyping me. And they win because their basic claim is we are a country in which racial groups are at each other's throats. And if that's how most voters go to the polls, then they will tend to vote for their racial team. That's the plan. Convince people that elections are really about electing your racial team. And so the way to break out of that is to say, you know what? Racism is really a weapon that's being used against all of us. It doesn't hurt us all in the same way. It doesn't affect us in the same manner to the same degree, but it's a weapon against all of us. And we lose when we think that we're on a racial team and that our enemy is the other racial team. We win when we recognize we're all in this together and that the people who threaten us are the people who intentionally stoke division so that they can hijack government and the economy for themselves.
We continue our conversation about how the main political parties have used race and class to make assumptions about people, about voters, and how they may have gotten it wrong. Ian Haney-Lopez is with us. His new book is Merge Left, Fusing Race and Class, Winning Elections and Saving America. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you feel like either or both political parties assume that they have your support or ignore you based on who you are, racially, class, whatever? Do you see more diversity in your own opinions and those around you than the media or politicians pay attention to? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll bring on a caller now. Christine is with us in Eau Claire. Christine, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about Christine?
Well, in terms of being judged, maybe that's not the question, but as an independent parent, single parent, I have definitely been judged. And my daughter has also been judged. And so I know I'm white, my daughter's white, but I feel like in the same way that people get judged or thought less are less than in terms of race, we have the same thing as a single parent. Even though I do have a college education, I've worked all my life, but I haven't made a lot of money, and we struggle, but that doesn't mean that we're not good people or have the same dreams and aspirations that others do.
Christine, thanks for the call. Ian, you focus mostly in your book on race and class. Do you see similar things going on with gender and family type?
Yes, very definitely. Though I would think about Christine's comments through the lens of class and what is the story that we're telling. So it's important to remember, and Wisconsin is the place to remember it. It's important to remember that 100 years ago, there used to be a story about class that said, hey, you're all on your own. Real men work hard and provide for their families. Real men don't need help. They don't need to join unions. They don't need help from the government. Go ahead and negotiate with the big boss. That was the sort of rhetoric that was used 100 years ago before the Great Depression. Then you get the Great Depression and people are like, that's a load of baloney. We're really in this together. And like Christine, there are a lot of people who are working really hard. And it depending on where they live, what jobs are available, the transportation network, they may or may not be able to make ends meet. And it's not a matter of whether they're working hard. And people understood that in the 30s and the 40s and the 50s and the 60s. What happened that since the 70s, we've lost that sense that a lot of working class folks and a lot of poor folks of whatever color, whatever gender, are working hard and are good and deserving people, and that we should take care of them through government programs that provide routes of upward mobility. How do we lose that? We lost that through a racial story that said, no, the people who are poor are actually undeserving because they're lazy. And you know what proves it? Look at how many African Americans are poor. You believe racist stereotypes about them. They're lazy, right? That just proves that the market works. And look at the middle class. Isn't the middle class white? Doesn't that prove that if you're hardworking, you can make it? And it's hard to see, but behind our stories about poverty reflecting character and a lack of discipline, and the middle class status or upper class status reflecting hard work more than anything else, behind those stories, there's a racial logic. And we all lose when we accept that racial logic. That's the racial logic that has caused people to turn against welfare, that caused so many states to oppose the Affordable Care Act, to ridicule it as Obamacare and reparations. But we all lose, right? There's assistance and programs and transportation and resources and childcare. There are things that Christine needs that we as a society used to provide, but we don't tend to provide it anymore because so many people have been convinced that people who are poor have nobody to blame but themselves. That's what we have to get beyond. And the way to get beyond it is to realize all of this language of racial division is really a weapon against all of us, and how it changes our views of other people in our society who are working hard and really do, like Christine says, really do have the same aspirations and dreams all the rest of us do.
Christine, thanks for that call. Now, in the news this week, you're talking about, Ian, racial divisions being used as kind of a lever in American politics. Another party came to the same conclusion. It turns out Russian hackers. The U.S. Senate reports that the Russian interference campaign on U.S. social media really focused on racially divisive messaging. What do you make of that?
I think it is a sad commentary on how racial division is an Achilles heel for the United States. It is easily available to be exploited. Listen, here's what I want to say, because this is very important. I think that a lot of people will react to a claim that says racial division is being intentionally used in our politics in a very defensive way. And partly the defensiveness is a sense of like, oh my gosh, you're accusing me of being a racist because, you know, I'm participating. No, I want to be very clear about this. Race is complex. We all have, if we've grown up in the United States, I as a Latino too, if we've grown up in the United States, we've internalized some ugly stereotypes. But we also understand that racism is a moral wrong, and in the ideal society, we would get beyond race and really take care of each other. What we also need to understand is that we have political leaders from both parties who sense that they can actually stir fear and anger and get people out to vote for them by promoting racial division. And this is not – there's nothing radical or revolutionary about this. This is what's been happening, and it's so commonplace. It's such an ugly aspect of what politics can be, that Russia can figure this out, that you can see this happening in Western Europe. You can see it happening even in the Philippines, even in Brazil. Politicians have the ability to win power by stirring fear and hatred in the public. That's just humanity. It happens here. It happens all over the world. In turn, if we're going to stop them, we need to hold on to our fundamental ideals that we are all in this together, that we're all created equal, that government is by and for the people. And we need to work purposefully to make those ideals real, by reaching across the very divisions that some politicians tell us pit each other at each other's throats.
We'll leave it there. Ian, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Delighted to join you. Thank you so much.
That's Ian Haney Lopez, professor of public law at the University of California, Berkeley. We've been talking about his latest book. It's called Merge Left, Fusing Race and Class, Winning Elections, and Saving America.